Good morning. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You're going to have to bear with me one more week as I try to get rid of this congestion. The most common progressive and disabling neurologic condition affecting young adults in the world is multiple sclerosis. Today, we're going to be discussing multiple sclerosis with Anchorage neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson. You can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can email us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Dr. Ellenson's been in Anchorage for approaching 3 years now. It's the second time he's been a guest on my program. I think he's a wonderfully knowledgeable neurologist, and he's very good at explaining things. That's one of the reasons we're having him back. He did his training at the Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, Oregon. Frank, welcome back to Line One.
Thank you.
Well, let's go and get right down to it. We're talking about multiple sclerosis. I'm a pediatrician, so I don't get involved with that, although I've had at least one mother that I can recall, and probably more that I've actually, more than now that I think about it, have had the diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. So I'm like the listeners. I want to learn as much as I can about this disorder. So what do we mean by multiple sclerosis?
Well, this is a very broad topic, so I'll try to keep it brief to some degree, and I don't think we could possibly cover it in 1 hour. But multiple sclerosis is a neurodegenerative condition affecting the brain and spinal cord, in particular the part of the central nervous system we refer to as white matter, and we could try to delineate that a little bit more later. But the condition principally is an autoimmune attack. Your immune system is attacking nerve cells in your central nervous system, resulting in multiple symptoms from problems with gait to vision difficulties, balance problems, weakness, sensory changes, even cognitive impairment over years.
So there's not a preferential part of the brain other than that part that has the myelin on it, that is attacked more often than others.
That's fairly true. The myelin is widespread throughout the brain. So there is not a single nerve center in the brain, if you will, that's more likely to be attacked. One of the most common conditions, though, is optic neuritis, which is when the myelin covering of the optic nerve is inflamed, and the symptoms can be fairly minor and just blurry vision or color desaturation or all the way to a permanent and complete blindness.
How common is it?
Well, the epidemiology suggests about 1 in 10,000 people.
And so we're a population of around 600, between 600 and 700,000. And so we would see...
Well, so there would be 10 per 100,000, so about 700.
Uh-huh. But there's some evidence, I know, that like other illnesses, it's been recognized that this may be more present in a gradient from the equator to northern latitudes. Is that also true?
That's very true, yeah, both in southern and northern hemispheres. So sort of think of north of Arkansas, Missouri, including Alaska, obviously, is at a higher risk than southern states. And it's interesting in that regard. It's not so much where you live when you're diagnosed with the condition, it's where you lived ages zero through about mid-teens. So if you grew up in Florida, you moved when you were 20 to Alaska, your risk doesn't increase. But if you grew up in Alaska, moved when you were 15 to Florida, you still maintain that northern kind of hemisphere risk.
Which suggests there's some environmental aspect to this.
Right. Environmental and genetic. It's probably a mixture.
Uh-huh. Which is a common paradigm being used now for a lot of inflammatory disorders, asthma, arthritis, multiple sclerosis.
Right.
Well, I'd like to go ahead and flesh out this idea of autoimmunity for a little bit. It's certainly a mechanism by which we explain a lot of chronic problems. What is meant exactly by that?
Right. Well, I'll take a step back and try to explain the theory behind perhaps MS and other autoimmune conditions. The idea here is that your immune system recognizes your own cells, in this case nerve cells, as being other than you. For instance, if you're exposed to a virus, your body mounts an immune response. develops antibodies to that virus, and the immune cells try to destroy that virus. In the case of MS, your immune cells are activated and stimulated to attack your nerve cells. So one of the theories behind that is that the protein structure that's maintained on all of your cells may be similar to a previous virus or bacteria particle that your immune system has been exposed to, and now your immune system, after dealing with that bacteria or virus, inadvertently begins to attack your nerve cell, in particular the myelin covering, inappropriately.
So the reason for that, in my mind, a little bit more generally, is your immune system's designed to protect you. So one of the primary things the immune system's got to do is figure out what's me and what's not me, because it wants to get rid of things that are not me.
Correct.
And it does that by recognizing proteins on the surface of cells. And so the theory is that something turns on parts of our immune system, and that immune system of ourselves is fooled into attacking parts of our body that may have a similar structure to what it should be attacking.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And rheumatic fever is the classic example that may have been one of the first ones. Lupus, some of the arthritides,
diabetes
have now been shown to work in this autoimmune way. What we don't know, at least I don't know, is what triggers that. The virus stimulation is the major thought process, and that's true also probably with MS.
Probably so. And you know, there were times in the history of MS where a single virus was thought to be responsible, but then sort of the research turned out to be not the case. So now it's still relatively vague, and it's more of a presumption of how it happens. There isn't clear proof that this is exactly what is going on.
Mm-hmm. So what would that have to do with northern latitudes?
Well, it could be an expression of endemic viruses, bacteria, allergens of some sort, which is more prevalent in northern hemispheres, maybe, you know, the longer winters or the cooler summers, although, you know, Midwestern summers are not cool. Mm-hmm. But it probably has something to do with what's endemic in the environment there.
What about the issue that immune modulators are lack of those? And I'm leading you down to the vitamin D path here. Vitamin D is being associated, and we've got to be careful and understand that association does not mean causality, but associated with a lot of immune-like disorders, including asthma and allergy and multiple sclerosis. So it is an immune modulator. It's very important for immune function. Where are we with vitamin D and MS?
That's a good and popular question.
What's the best evidence? I mean, it's popular. Right. That doesn't mean it's correct, and that's where I'm interested.
Well, with MS in particular, and especially the northern latitude association with MS, also northern latitude populations are exposed to less sun in general and would be expected to have a lower average vitamin D level. So the argument could be made that these things are related to the fact of where you live and that one doesn't cause the other. On the other hand, if you look at a population of patients with similar sun exposure and relatively similar ages and other medical conditions, a patient with MS has a much stronger likelihood of having a low vitamin D level than someone else in that same community. Now, that to me makes it very reasonable to recommend supplementation with vitamin D for MS patients, even with relatively normal vitamin D levels, not heroic dosages, but the typical recommended dosages of usually around 2,000 international units a day. We're still waiting to see, as the years go by, whether supplementing with vitamin D can reduce the number of relapses one has with MS or prevent disability, or what favorable, you know, outcome will occur because of vitamin D supplementation.
So I guess one of the important points is lots of things might be associated with multiple sclerosis and northern latitudes. Mosquito bites, for example. I'm just talking off the top of my head. I'm not sure that's true. But so what we need are these prospective studies where we're comparing people, where we know what they're getting and over time what happens. And you've also alluded to treatment. So another issue is You said you're not hesitant to recommend vitamin D. There's very little risk to reasonable levels, and it may have some effect on preventing or modifying the outcome of this disorder as well.
Potentially. At the very least, you know, it makes sense given all the other potential benefits of vitamin D supplementation in people who have a low level that I'm not hesitant at all to prescribe. And in fact, I do to most patients.
Back to the epidemiology a little bit, Frank. What do we know about the age and races? Since this is a there seems to be some variation by latitude that brings in some more dark-complected races in certain parts of the world. And does that seem to help us understand what's happening with this disease?
Well, I'm not positive it helps us understand necessarily what causes the disease or how to treat it, but there certainly is population-based differences. So it's a more common disease among women, for one, among Caucasians more than Asians or African-Americans. And the typical age of onset is somewhere between 20 and 50 and usually between 20 and 40.
And that's irregardless of, you said it's where you were raised as a child that predicts that correlates with the onset.
Correct. Right. Exactly.
And the other thing that raises some questions about vitamin D is that the darker complected races, particularly black individuals who are born and raised in northern climates, do not have more vitamin D, it would sound like you're telling me, and yet they're much higher risk. For example, I've only seen rickets in babies that were black and breastfed where they're not getting enough vitamin D, whereas we see low levels of vitamin D in some Caucasian kids. So that dark skin also decreases the amount of metabolism of vitamin D production in the skin.
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about that a whole lot. I don't think that there's a great correlation right now between vitamin D levels, dark skin, and MS. It's generally African-American population with MS is fairly small, and I just don't know if those studies have been completed. Probably not.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get back to the disorder. So we've got this autoimmune attack by our immune system to the myelin that's covering nerves in our central nervous system. And that's a big organ, extremely complex. So I'm guessing there is quite a bit of variability in the symptoms and presentation.
There's a huge variability. And one of the challenging and I guess somewhat interesting parts of dealing with MS is the abnormalities seen on an MRI, a patient's MRI of the brain, for instance, won't necessarily correspond well with symptoms the patient's experiencing. Now, if someone were to have a stroke and you show a neurologist the MRI of the brain after the stroke, there'd be pretty good predictability about the symptoms that patient would be suffering, whether it's weakness, numbness, discoordination, blindness. But with MS, it's much more variable. Many of the abnormalities seen on an MRI in MS will be asymptomatic, and sometimes some patient will have symptoms that you just can't quite explain by the abnormalities on the MRI. I guess the one exception to that, the one rule with MS where imaging almost always tells the story is within the spinal cord. And I think the reason for that is you could sort of consider the spinal cord is a very small structure, and almost every square millimeter of the spinal cord is carrying nerves that have valuable information, whether it's motor function to move arms or legs, help with balance, or sensory function that allows you to know where your limbs are in space or feel pain or temperature. So you're not able to get away with abnormalities in the spinal cord, whereas in the brain, where there's larger areas of the brain involved in different sensations or movements, there's more space to compensate for abnormalities in the brain where there isn't in the spinal cord.
Let me remind our listeners real quickly, if you've got questions or comments today, our topic is multiple sclerosis. My guest is Dr. Frank Ellenson, an Anchorage neurologist. You can reach us by calling 550-8433, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888 353-5752, and you can email us at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. Please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 tonight, Monday night, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we won't be answering questions at that time. Let me get back to that last comment. So you're saying that if there's abnormalities in the spinal cord, they much more highly or much more likely to correlate with what may be seen on imaging studies.
Right. You don't often get asymptomatic spinal cord abnormalities in MS. If I meet someone who, for instance, has numbness from the waist down and symptoms in both his or her legs, I'm fairly confident there's going to be an abnormality somewhere in the spinal cord. Whereas if it's a unilateral symptom or only happening in one arm or one leg, I don't know for sure where that abnormality is going to be found on the MRI.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the imaging studies for that, but before we get into some of this diagnostic stuff, tell me some more about the variability of symptoms and presentation of patients.
It is variable, especially when I talk to a patient who finally is diagnosed with MS. He or she might tell me there's been symptoms off and on for 5 or 10 years, you know, and it was thought maybe I slept on my arm wrong, or I twisted my shoulder, or I sprained my ankle, and that's the explanation, or I was just born that way. But, you know, the symptoms can be very subtle, from burning and tingling in a foot, or what we call a foot drop, where the foot just doesn't raise appropriately as you're walking, to something much more obvious, which is, you know, a flaccid, weak limb, or blindness in an eye, vertigo or imbalance, difficulty with chewing or swallowing.
Do these symptoms also wax and wane in their development, such that you may have burning and tingling one day and the next day you don't? It's just that it's slowly, progressively happening more and more, or is it just starts happening and then it just slowly progresses without much waxing and waning?
Well, in answer to that question, I'll make a statement about MS in general. There's the most common form of MS, which is relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. This is a condition where symptoms seem to suddenly come on, developing over just a couple days or as short as a few hours. And then the symptoms typically last many days or even weeks long, and then start to recover, and oftentimes recover almost completely back to normal. And that can go on for you know, several years or decades, where symptoms are quite intermittent, can be very, very significant, but often recover. Over time, though, having these relapses occur often leaves some degree of disability, which seems to be slowly progressive over the years. So I think in answering your original question is, usually the symptoms don't vary from day to day in a dramatic fashion. If symptoms begin in an arm, typically the symptoms remain there for several days or weeks, and then the arm starts to improve, whether it's motor function or sensory function, and the next relapse can be, you know, days, weeks, months, or years later, and can often be in different parts of the body.
We have a caller, and I want to take her call, and then we'll proceed. Elaine, you're on line one.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can.
Hi, yes, I just had a question on comparative MRI from year to year to what do studies show, what does the research show on the accuracy of comparing lesions and the changes in MRIs from year to year, particularly in patients that aren't on medication, and trying to monitor, kind of watchful waiting, trying to see changes that occur. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okie doke. Thanks for your call.
I think maybe referring or answering this question more generally as what imaging means in MS might be helpful, and then I'll try to specifically ask, I think it was Elaine's Elaine's question. In days prior to head CTs and MRIs, MS was 100% a clinical diagnosis. And then, you know, with the knowledge behind years of autopsy studies correlating what pathology showed in autopsies to what patients experienced and trying to match those up after that patient were to die, we learned an awful lot. As the head CTs and MRIs came online, there was a period of time where there was needing to correlate what an abnormality on pathology would look like on an MRI, for instance. So nowadays, we are given the opportunity to make a diagnosis of MS many sometimes years earlier than would have been the case before MRIs existed. So we see typical what we call white spots or bright spots in the white matter of the patient's brain MRI and correlate that with the patient's symptoms. And if the abnormalities on the MRI are typical for MS and fit a normal pattern and don't look like something else like a stroke or a tumor or an infection, then we're able to use MRIs to our advantage in making the diagnosis. Now, I think in Elaine's question is when someone isn't on treatment for multiple sclerosis, what's the utility of an MRI? How often should they be done? And what does it all mean? When there's been a patient who's been completely asymptomatic, never having a typical relapse syndrome or symptom from MS, MRIs may show white spots that, you know, could look like MS. We sometimes call that radiologically isolated syndrome. And most MS experts are not recommending treating that condition now, at least until more research is done. So I may meet a patient who had a brain MRI because there was a fall and a head injury or because that patient has headaches, and lo and behold, there's several white spots, and we're left to interpret what those mean. And many different things can cause those spots. If the spots are seemingly very typical of MS, it makes sense to repeat that MRI once or twice or maybe even three times over the next several years to see if there's any new spots developing. If the white spots are from a previous head injury or a stroke during childbirth, then they probably shouldn't be developing new abnormalities. On the other hand, if the syndrome or the abnormalities on the MRI are due to MS, well, MS being a progressive condition would likely mean future MRIs will have more abnormalities. And I've gone on a bit here, but one more important factor there is the use of contrast on an MRI is very helpful with MS, especially when you're trying to diagnose it. The contrast is given through the IV into a vein. Now, normally the brain's very good at keeping what's in your bloodstream out of the brain and just remains in the veins and arteries. When an active MS abnormality is occurring or developing, some of that contrast will leak out of the arteries into the brain tissue itself, and that shows us there's something actively going on, which is much more suggestive of MS than of older abnormalities which are not active.
And how about the is there good correlation between MRIs changes over time and progressive MS symptoms? I mean, it's a little different question.
Yeah, there is correlation. I hesitate to say really good correlation. Mm-hmm. By and large, given the option, if you're a patient, you want the fewest radiologic abnormalities that you can have. On the other hand, every neurologist has seen patients who are doing poorly with MS but have a relatively okay brain MRI, and the opposite is very true, where you can see someone who constantly has new lesions developing on the MRI, and the MRI is very, very abnormal, but he or she is doing fairly well day to day.
Why would those be the case? I'm thinking of the first case where maybe the microscopic, the injury to the myelin is so small that it's beyond right. The ability of our technology to see it. But the converse is not so easy to understand.
It isn't easy to understand. I think part of that will be age related. Mm-hmm. Young people who have a terrific ability to tolerate physical and medical insults may have really advanced abnormalities on an MRI, but due to their youth, you know, are able to function pretty well. Probably as those patients age, symptoms will accumulate. On the other hand, you know, there's some speculation that there's more than one, you know, variety of MS, and for genetic reasons or for some other undetermined reason, someone's more susceptible to these lesions than someone else.
And another comment I would have, that when I was in training, I was always taught you diagnose and treat the patient, not the lab. And that gets back to this comment that you were making about the not perfect correlation between MRIs and symptoms, and such that you're hesitant to make maybe the diagnosis and specifically expose people to treatment based just on an MRI in particular. Is that kind of what you're saying also, or is there more to it?
Well, I think there's a little bit more to it because what's been found is the earlier you treat someone with mm-hmm. MS with preventive therapy, the better off that patient will be 5, 10, or 20 years down the road. Okay. So there's even been studies to show if you think someone has MS, we mm-hmm. sort of list it as clinically definite MS or clinically probable MS. If you treat someone who probably has MS, and I don't mean that in a wishy-washy way. What I mean to say is that years from now, that patient will fall into the category of clinically definite MS. But you try to treat that patient when it's not clear, not 100% the case that he or she has MS, and you can oftentimes delay for years when that final diagnosis will be made. And in that same time period, you may have saved that patient one or two or several relapses and maybe saved several MRI abnormalities from developing, and in the long run have prevented some disability. So it's pretty important to figure out, did that symptom correlate with an abnormal MRI? Does this look like MS? And if it probably is, it's a pretty good bet that that patient should be on a therapy.
Yeah, so this is where it, in my mind, it's important for patients to understand the complexity of this. You don't want to treat too early, but there's plenty of evidence, there's suggestive evidence that treating early is important, and yet sometimes it may not be clear. So that's where you really have to be, I guess, talking with patients about where you are. What is the, do we have the ability to say how often lesions that look like MS are true false positives and may be something else?
Well, that is difficult. It kind of depends. When there's lesions located in parts of the brain that are especially associated with MS, then it becomes less likely there's a better explanation. On the other hand, if I'm meeting a patient in his or her 50s who has hypertension and diabetes and other risk factors for developing abnormalities in the brain associated with age, then it is possible that there's an alternative explanation other than MS. So that's a really difficult question. It's all about situation, sure. Symptoms, age, risk factors.
All right. We're going to take a short break, as we usually do on this program right about now, and remind you that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. You can reach us about any questions or comments you have at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@kska.org. After this brief break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails if you want to as we discuss multiple sclerosis with Anchorage neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're speaking with Anchorage neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson, and our topic is multiple sclerosis. You can email your questions and comments to line1@kska.org, or you can give us a call and ask your questions or make your comments. 550-8433 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remind you once again that if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be able to help you with your questions at that time. Pat, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I'd like to ask the doctor if there's a correlation between MS and a young age, a diagnosis of transverse myelitis.
Oh, great question. What's transverse myelitis first?
Sure. Transverse myelitis is a focal white matter injury in the spinal cord. So the pathology and the radiology are very similar between MS and transverse myelitis. Now, I think this was in reference to a young patient. I'm going to presume someone, say, under 20. The radiology looks a bit different in transverse myelitis compared to MS. And usually, if a young patient has transverse myelitis and has a normal brain MRI and recovers well, there's not a very significant increase in the risk of developing MS. On the other hand, in someone with either a known history of MS or retrospectively symptoms suggestive of MS and an abnormal brain MRI, it could be that the episode of transverse myelitis is a part of the MS disease itself. So usually in a young person with isolated transverse myelitis, not a great increase in risk of developing MS, which is usually good news.
Thank you very much. That answers my question.
Okay. All right. So the issue is there is a separate thing, transverse myelitis. It doesn't necessarily progress on, but it could be, in the right situation, the beginning of MS.
The beginning or a condition that develops at some point during a patient's history of MS.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take a couple more calls. Susan, you're on line one.
Yes, I have two questions. The first is I'm interested to know how often you see tremors and uncontrolled muscular movements in MS patients. And my second question is, can strokes initiate MS or cause it to accelerate?
Well, let me start with the stroke question. And I think the answer, and most neurologists would accept this, is that strokes will not initiate or cause MS to develop. On the other hand, if someone already has a brain disease like MS and has some disability or decreased function, then another brain insult, whether it's a head injury or a stroke, can significantly worsen that patient's condition more so than a stroke would in someone who doesn't have MS. On the first question about tremors and uncontrolled muscle movements, I think that's a case-by-case situation. Generally speaking, MS doesn't cause a tremor like with Parkinson's disease or an inherited family tremor. On the other hand, MS can cause difficulty with movements and spasticity and stiffness in arms or legs that can very often look like a tremor in the more traditional use of the word. So certainly movements can become abnormal and have a tremoring component to that with MS. And there's often medications that can help with that, maybe not completely, but sometimes mitigate those symptoms.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Anna, you're on line one.
Yes, I have been diagnosed with MS 20 years ago, and it is currently controlled with Copaxone. The question I have concerns with, as you get older, is there a component of where you find yourself mentally not as sharp as you would might have been with just normal aging? I find myself really having to concentrate on things, really have to concentrate on the words I'm using, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the answer to the question simply is yes. The way I look at it a little bit is we sort of have a peak learning age, and it probably ends at around 30, where after that, our ability to learn new information or skills declines, but usually pretty slowly, so that the average person functions very well into his 60s or 70s, depending on other risk factors. On the other hand, you wouldn't expect, or I wouldn't expect myself to be as sharp when I'm 80 as I am now, and probably was sharper 10 years ago, unfortunately. With MS, you have injury to various parts of the brain, and I sort of look at aging with MS as more of an accelerated aging, where you know you're losing some nerve cells just simply by day-to-day living, and that accumulates over years. But you've already had an injury to your brain in the form of MS, so the two are compounded, and things become more difficult at an earlier age for patients with MS.
Okay. Can it also kind of accelerate Alzheimer's if it runs in your family?
I don't know that it would accelerate Alzheimer's disease, but I think the two conditions together would be more difficult to deal with. Your symptoms or your ability to function well independently would be worse with both conditions at once instead of just one or the other.
All right. Well, thank you for your time, sir.
You're welcome.
Do other dementias often happen at the same time as multiple sclerosis? And again, I'm looking for hints about what's happening here. I mean, you would expect people with multiple sclerosis, I would suspect, to have the similar incidence of all the dementia, many of the dementias as other people. Is that true or not true is what
well,
I'm trying
think,
to say.
I think the pathology of a patient with MS who also has Alzheimer's disease, under a microscope, you would clearly see an Alzheimer's picture if that patient has that condition additionally. So there's, I don't think, a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or a variant dementia due to having MS. But I think that, well, I know that cognitive impairment is something that's fairly common among patients who age with MS, but I think that is isolated and part of the condition MS, and then you could have situations, unfortunately, where there's a second brain disease going on, like Alzheimer's disease.
Are the cognitive dissidences that occur in MS characteristic of MS, that is, executive function versus memory versus different kinds of memory, or is it all over the place?
It is all over the place. No great particular focus on the type of cognitive impairment someone would see with MS.
Let me do or give the listeners our contact information again. If you have questions or comments, you've got roughly about 20 minutes or so if you would like us, or actually Frank, not me, to answer questions. So our number locally is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@kska.org. I'm a little interested in this difficulty in making diagnosis, so my next question gets back to this. What's the natural history of untreated multiple sclerosis? I suspect you're going to tell me it's variable again, but I'm interested in what happens in people that are untreated, or what do we know about untreated MS?
Well, again, taking the common type of MS, the relapse and remitting case, that's representative of about 85% of cases of MS. Now, again, typically onset between age 20 and 40. And in the first 10 to 20 years, that's the part of the natural history where relapses are seen, where periodically, oftentimes estimated about once per year or once every other year, a new neurological event will occur, whether it's a vision problem, trouble with balance, numbness, gait, motor function in arms or legs, lasting several days or weeks and then recovering almost back to baseline. And then the next relapse may be months or years later. As time goes on, after you've had the disease for about 20 years, it's fairly well accepted that the relapse rate really slows down or stops even. And then sometimes patients will progress into the phase called secondary progressive MS, where instead of having clear new severe problems, it's more of a linear decline in function. It's oftentimes fairly slow, but it can be quite disabling.
This remitting nature suggests that there might be injury followed by repair followed by injury. Is that thought to be the process, or we don't know, or something else is happening?
That is thought to be the process, where studies under a microscope will show that, you know, during the injury, the myelin covering and even the axons themselves, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that, the nerve fibers themselves can be injured. And then there's a period of time where the myelin is restored, but usually it's not as healthy or robust as the myelin that we're born with or that develops after we're born. So there is an injury and a recovery phase, and then a re-injury, oftentimes in different parts of the central nervous system.
Okay. What about these difficult patients that have minimal symptoms and maybe minimal findings on MRI? Are there ancillary tests that can help make the diagnosis for sure?
There are additional tests. After the MRI, the most common test would be a lumbar puncture, a spinal tap, where the spinal fluid is evaluated for, well, first excluding other possible conditions, and then secondarily analyzed to see if it's supportive of the diagnosis of MS. In the case of MS, you'll see elevated levels of immune proteins. Now, up to 10% of patients who clearly do have MS will have normal spinal fluid evaluations, but that means that 90% of the patients with MS will have the immune proteins seen in the analysis. So that is a pretty helpful test. If the MRIs are only suggestive of MS but not diagnostic, lumbar punctures are often done to help speed up the diagnosis so that a better understanding of the condition and maybe initiating earlier therapy can be done.
Okay. Russ, you're on line one.
Yes, my question is for Dr. Ellenson. Question about molecular mimicry of cell proteins by food proteins, and any research that has been done on modifying your diet and the elimination of certain hypersensitive foods that would mimic the cell proteins as a way of dealing with your MS?
All right, that's a good question and somewhat common of a question. The answer simply is yes, there has been studies completed to try to determine what a good diet for MS will be. There was a lecture that I listened to from the American Academy of Neurology about just the same thing. In the 70s and 80s, I think it was, there was a professor actually where I trained. He was gone before I got there, however, who did a lot of research on changing diets for MS. And that's a really challenging thing to prove, I think. It's really hard to know what a patient's diet is when he or she, you know, is enrolled in a year-long study. The evidence isn't convincing. Most MS centers do not believe there's a particular diet that's especially geared for patients with MS. The way I look at it is a normal, healthy diet with exercise and good rest is probably the best recommendation. You do have an autoimmune condition, stress, and I don't especially mean work stress or social stress, but I mean stress to the body. Not eating well, not sleeping well, not exercising is probably not good for you. So I usually just recommend as many fruits and vegetables as you can eat, lean meats, and generally a good healthy diet. So in answer to your question, I don't think there's an accepted diet that's especially good for MS. In fact, I think that most of the analysis suggests against this at this time.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Without promoting that idea, I think I have a couple comments. And Frank, I'd like you to perhaps maybe comment as well. I'm not aware of any autoimmune disorder that the trigger is fairly well established to be a food. So that would be against that idea. And there's lots of autoimmune diseases and lots of research going into the triggering mechanism. But on the other side, it is well established, I think, to say that some allergic reactions due to foods can cause symptoms. And I'm thinking of particularly people who are allergic to birch, for example, will often have something called the oral allergy syndrome, where their mouth will itch. They may even get a little swelling in their throat with exposure to fresh apple, to bananas, almonds. And it's due to a cross-reaction between birch, the protein in birch, and in these foods. These foods, if they're cooked, the protein denatures and it doesn't happen. So, I mean, the precedent to some degree is there, but this it's actually a different immune response with multiple sclerosis. We're talking about T cells. We're talking about cell-mediated versus antibody-related. I don't want to get into it in too depth, but I think that the question merits some thought. But on the other hand, there's despite lots of people looking, we've not found anything like that.
Right. And the way I look at it now, 10 years from now, we may understand exactly the cause of MS, whether it's a particular virus or a gene is found for to explain every case of MS. What I can't support at this time is based on evidence that there's a clear allergic food antigen that explains MS or that changing a diet will impact the course of MS. That may change. 15 years ago, there were no treatments for MS sort of on a daily basis to prevent relapses, and that's very, very different than now. So our thinking may change on this, but you're right, there's been a fair amount of research looking for a cause of MS, looking for relationships between food and antigens, and nothing has been proven.
Okay. Gretchen, you're on line one.
Hi. I was diagnosed with MS in 2002 at the age of 23, and I had my second attack came after leaving a movie theater, which had very a lot of type strobe lights kind of things in the movie. And I was wondering, I've been hesitant to see movies and so forth like that since that time because I basically, and it might just be a mere coincidence where I walked out of the theater and happened to just have an attack. But I was wondering, and I know that epilepsy can trigger things like that, and I was wondering if there's any link between that and MS?
Probably not. But I completely understand your hesitancy when I think that's a big imprinting psychologically when you've experienced a really bad thing. When you're exposing yourself to a certain activity, which isn't it's going to a movie isn't a routine day-to-day activity. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the pathology of MS, or I should say an individual attack, likely has been going on for many hours or days before the symptoms even develop. Mm-hmm. So it would be pretty unlikely that the light effect from being in a dark movie and watching the screen for 2 hours would trigger that and allow the well-known pathology of an MS attack to develop in that short period of time. Now, the epilepsy with flashing lights is usually a genetic childhood epilepsy, and that's very different. And there's not an abnormality on an MRI of the brain in someone with epilepsy like that. It's more a genetic abnormality and probably an ion channel abnormality in the seizure disorder case. But that's a good question, and I completely understand your hesitancy, but I'm hoping you're still able to catch a movie on occasion.
No, it just was one of those things that I was newly diagnosed and, as you can imagine, very afraid. And I figured it was mere coincidence because I've been seeing movies since then, and I've exposed myself to similar circumstances and never had a problem. But I was just curious if there had been any proof or if it was just a mere coincidence,
probably a coincidence, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Congratulations on recognizing that coincidences occur. Yeah. Not everybody thinks that way.
When you have a disease like MS, you can't just run around like a chicken with your head cut off and freak out about everything.
Yeah. True.
Yep. I understand that myself. I used to have cluster headaches, and I had one attack start after drinking a beer from Thailand. You would not get me near alcohol in any way, shape, or form after that for a long time. They disappeared, and I have to say I occasionally have a beer. So, we haven't talked about treatment, Frank. Right. Is there? I'm assuming you're going to tell me there's nothing we know that prevents the onset, but you've alluded to doing some things once you've been diagnosed that may delay consequences.
That's very true. There's four injectable agents, ranging from once a week to every single day, and at least one IV therapy that's becoming more and more common, and that's once per month. So without naming drugs necessarily, there's a class of drugs called interferons, which are normal, are products of our own immune system, secreted usually in the time of infection or immunologic stress. And those immune products help, we believe, and honestly, we don't have an absolute understanding of how they impact MS, but we believe they help to favor the immune system in a way as to quiet it down or decrease its activity, whereas some other immune proteins may increase the activity of the immune system and cause more of an attacking kind of state. So there's three of those drugs. The earliest one's been around for over 12 years now, probably closer to 15 years, actually. And there's another injectable drug that's every day. It's called glatiramer acetate. And this is truly an interesting chemical. It's composed solely of four amino acids that are randomly put together in variable length peptide chains. A peptide is a protein which is composed of amino acids. And this was developed for use in research, trying to mimic what the covering of a nerve cell might look like from a protein point of view. And when it was used in a mouse model of MS, it was found to actually decrease the rate of attacks. And then after studies with other animals and finally in humans, it was found to reduce the relapse rate and decrease the rate of accumulating abnormalities on an MRI, and now it's become one of the four standard therapies.
How effective is it? I mean, you know, it works. What can you tell a patient who has got MS? Here's an option. Here are some options.
Right.
Here's what we would expect to happen, and what are the risks, so that they look at the risk-benefit ratio.
So, again, splitting those medications into groups, the interferon medications do typically have a side effect after injection. Within minutes to hours, you may feel aches and pains, headaches, fevers, chills. And sometimes it can be very minimal, and other times it can be so significant that the patient reasonably gives it a try but then decides to switch from that medication. Usually, however, taking acetaminophen or ibuprofen can mitigate a lot of those side effects. And then the benefits of the medication would be to slow the relapse rate from anywhere from 25 to 50%, depending on the study, and decrease, again, the accumulation of MRI abnormalities up to 50%. The same can be said for glatiramer acetate, where it, on the other hand, has very few side effects. It's an everyday injection, which is difficult to sell to patients. However, it does not have those side effects with aches and pains and fevers, and there's no lab monitoring, no blood tests for that drug. And it has a similar efficacy to the others. And finally, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention a monoclonal antibody treatments called natalizumab or Tysabri. And that's a monthly infusion IV, which is better, relapse rate speaking, and also MRI, than any of the injectables. That one does have a significant risk, however, and that is the development of a brain infection. But I think the actual risk of that brain infection, estimated at about 1 in 1,000 patients per year, but the risk of that infection actually speaks to how successful that drug is. It's a drug that is meant to keep immune cells from migrating into your brain and central nervous system, and is so effective that sometimes this virus called the JC virus can become active when normally that virus wouldn't cause a normal immune system any difficulty whatsoever. So thinking about that medication, it's very successful in preventing the immune cells from getting into the brain and from causing any MS damage. But over time, it has a risk of allowing that virus to proliferate and cause sometimes a very serious illness.
I'm getting the picture, Frank, and we've only got a minute or two here. It's just getting away from me real quickly, that this is a highly treatable disease now.
It is. It's much more treatable than it was prior to these medications existing. And there's a much stronger likelihood that a patient with MS will live a full life, in the sense that there's, you know, chances to work regularly, have a family, and look more at this as a treatable condition instead of a severely progressive, debilitating condition.
So it's more of a chronic, controllable disease than a progressive disease that it was in the past.
It's better than in the past, and there's an awful lot of patients doing very, very well who, you know, no one would recognize as having a neurological condition. On the other hand, there still are a fair number of patients who, despite the best available medical therapies, you know, just continue to progress and have a pretty poor course with the disease.
And these medications are all immune modulators, is how they're working. They're dampening or affecting our immune response. Those are often very, very pricey medications. I assume that their cost is excessive, but they're not experimental, so that insurance companies are pretty willing to reimburse. Can I say that?
True.
Is that possible?
Very expensive and usually covered sometimes with a boatload of paperwork preceding that.
All right. Well, we're coming up towards the end of this hour, and I always like to end with what's the most important lesson that you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
That's a tricky one with MS. I think important lesson is, if it's clear that you have MS, or at least highly probable, that there are medications available which truly have been shown to help prevent progression of the disease and limit disability. So that's a really positive thing to take away and to consider. Medication isn't right for everyone, and some patients just, you know, don't need it or don't want it, and that's very understandable given the costs and potential side effects. But it's a very different world for MS during my career than it was in the career of the professors who taught me.
And one of the things I've learned is it's reasonably important to think about starting early in the treatment of this disorder.
That's true, because the relapse rate is fairly high early on in the condition. That's where these medications are effective. And if you could stop a few relapses and perhaps prevent disability from developing, you've truly helped that patient.
Frank, it's been a fast, enjoyable, very educational hour. I appreciate your time once more.
Glad to be here.
For everyone who is listening, this is Dr. Frank Ellenson again, who's joined us. He's an Anchorage neurologist. Next week, Line 1 is going to return. We're going to be on a different topic. We're going to be talking about parenting issues, a little bit closer to my heart, with family therapist Susan Stifelman from California. She's an expert in giving parenting advice and has recently published a book called Parenting Without Power Struggles. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media, and Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'll try to be back without a croak next week. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.